From Latrobe to Grantham, Lebanon to Uniontown, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, Pennsylvania voters handed Governor Tom Wolf a vote of no confidence on primary election day, approving two constitutional amendments that would curb his emergency powers. David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is here to host a Capitol Watch roundtable discussion. And Pennsylvania and Florida each took a very different approach to combating the COVID-19 pandemic. On my town hall commentary, I'll have a tale of two governors. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capitol Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first we have news headlines from patownhall.com. Pennsylvania House Speaker Brian Cutler of Lancaster County introduced legislation this past week that would establish a Bureau of Election Audits under the office of the state's Auditor General. According to the Center Square, the Bureau would be required to conduct result-confirming audits of each election in the Commonwealth completed by the third Friday after the election. Cutler said the audits would comprehensively examine all future elections, looking at all aspects of the process and results to ensure public trust in the outcome of each election. The speaker said the audit process is needed, so there is not, quote, even a shred of uncertainty in the outcome. Meanwhile, Auditor General Tim DeFore says the state lacks enough protection to ensure the $55 billion in federal pandemic relief dollars are spent effectively and without fraud or abuse. Saying Pennsylvania, quote, did not win the lottery, DeFore said there were not enough safeguards in place for past funds received to fight the negative impacts of the pandemic. Specifically, he cited the state's Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, which has had thus far to recover up to $800 million in stolen benefits. With a significantly larger pot of money on the way, DeFore said the legislature needs to approve additional safeguards. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Voters on primary election day handed Governor Tom Wolf an historic rebuke, approving two constitutional amendments that would give the state legislature the clear ability to curtail the draconian measures he has implemented, supposedly to fight the COVID-19 pandemic. Our Capitol Watch crew is here to discuss that and other election results. David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is joined by Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association and by Jeremy Baker from Commonwealth Partners Chamber of Entrepreneurs. David?
And welcome once again to Capitol Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me in the studio, Rebecca Euler, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association. Rebecca, thanks for being here.
Great to be here again, David. Thank you.
So we survived the Pennsylvania primary, and that the voters have rendered their respective verdicts. And to help to go through the entrails, to sift through the wreckage, we have our pal Jeremy Baker, Political Director for Commonwealth Partners Chamber of Entrepreneurs. Jeremy, thanks for being here.
Great to be here, Dave.
So obviously the big headline, let freedom ring, that the voters validated and approved the two constitutional amendments to end the emergency declaration, to curb the governor's executive powers to declare an emergency and to keep us in that indefinitely. So your overview of that battle.
Yes, certainly. I think this is a first step in a nationwide trend of voters, individuals declaring their freedom from excessive and oppressive governments. And we're excited that it happened right here in Pennsylvania, the place where the Liberty Bell was rung, where freedom started. It's good to be back here again, where we're leading the country again on major issues.
Yes, sir. And so the one of the most galling things, and like every once in a while, like every time that I think that I'm cynical enough, something will happen that makes me realize that I still need to catch up. And the deliberate miswording of the ballot questions to distort people's understanding of the result of those questions. Like, That was genuinely shocking to me. And Rebecca, you spent some time working in the Department of State. I mean, how does that even happen?
It was shocking. I could not believe it when I read the questions. I've never seen such convoluted language. So the good news is that the voters saw through that for sure, because obviously the ballot questions were voted in the affirmative, which we're really happy about here. It's funny, I had just read an article that a professional organization that sort of grades language on ballot questions took a look at these ballot questions. And the very first one on the list, the one that would allow a simple majority to overturn the disaster declaration, was graded at a grade level of 37.
I got a few of those in high school.
Yeah.
So, no.
But that would be like, but a college graduate would be grade 16.
Exactly. Like a 12th grader should be able to read at a 12th grade level. A 16th grade language should be a college graduate.
So that would this be like a shaman or a wizard or something?
Something like that, yeah.
Oh, my.
37. So that's how difficult it was to interpret
and
that language.
And how extreme the intent to deceive.
Yes. And there are some efforts now in the General Assembly to amend how constitutional amendments are advertised and how that wording is developed. So I hope to see that that's, you know, successful, because this should not happen again.
Well, and aside from the language being deliberately misleading, we saw the administration as a whole engage in a misinformation campaign for months.
That's correct.
Leading up to the vote, from the governor himself to his various department heads, saying things about money getting taken away or things changing or how people are harmed. I mean, the head of PEMA held 5 press conferences the last several weeks before the election. He held 5 in total the first few months of the pandemic itself. So clearly they were out to misinform the Pennsylvania voter, and clearly they did not succeed in their efforts.
So this is a new beginning, and it's not like a huge sweeping victory, but rather it establishes a beachhead from which the General Assembly can begin to reclaim its authority, to reestablish balance of power between the what are supposed to be co-equal branches of government, and also to start liberating Pennsylvania from the worst effects of Governor Wolf's lockdown.
And Rebecca touched on this earlier. The General Assembly has started moving legislation through that would end in part and continue in part the governor's disaster declaration. And we're going to see more and more efforts, whether it's to amend that or at least have conversations around what the legislature can do now that it has that power to limit and protect Pennsylvanians. Because that's what ultimately this is about, is protecting people's lives, protecting people's livelihoods from a unilateral and arbitrary rule from the governor.
But this uniform power grab, really, that the governor has taken over the past year and a half. I believe this is, what, the fourth time he re-signed the 90-day declaration this past year?
Yeah.
4 times. So really, you have a governor who was completely in control of his own power. Like, you had no
– He was unassailable.
Right. There was no way other than amending our Constitution to reinstitute a balance of power. So I just think it's amazing that we had to get to this point to even, you know, get someone to listen in the governor's office to some of these concerns.
Because amending the Constitution should not be an everyday occurrence. This is something that really would only happen in the most extraordinary circumstances. But that's the situation Governor Wolf put us in.
I mean, he put himself in a position where it was actually easier for the legislature to impeach him than override his power. And that's why we had to take the drastic step of amending the Constitution.
The voters also approved enshrining protections against discrimination by race or ethnicity, and also approved a ballot resolution that was about allowing the Commonwealth to extend, is it loans or grants to fire departments?
Volunteer fire departments.
Well, it gave access to certain municipal fire departments to that same kind of loan and grant process that volunteer firefighters have right now.
Gotcha. So those things were uncontroversial. But anyway, this is where we are now, moving into the next phase of Pennsylvania's future. You're listening to Capital Watch. I'm your host, David Taylor from PMA. With me on the program, Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association and Jeremy Baker from Commonwealth Partners Chamber of Entrepreneurs. So along with the ballot questions, which, you know, for me were the things that mattered most of all, there were also some really consequential primary elections that were held, but also there were some special elections. Can you let's start with the special elections. Can you walk us through those?
Certainly. There were four special elections. We had two state Senate elections and two state House elections. Let's start with the Senate. We had one in the 48th district. It's Lebanon County, bits of Dauphin and York. Very Republican seat. Chris Gebhard, the Republican, won pretty easily, relatively uncontested race.
And he's succeeding Dave Arnold, the incumbent who passed away.
Correct. And then the other seat is in the 22nd district, which is Lackawanna, Luzerne, Monroe counties. It's replacing John Blake, who was stepping down. It was an interesting contest between a state rep, Marty Flynn, from Scranton area, and the Lackawanna County Commissioner, Chris Shermack. That race was contested, but ultimately Flynn won pretty easily by 14 points, 51-37, with a third-party candidate taking about 10% of the vote.
And so in each case, the incumbent party retained the seat.
Correct.
So yep. It doesn't affect the balance of power in the chamber.
The Senate will still be 28-21 with one independent. In the House, we had two races, both in Western PA. One to replace Mike Reese, who had passed away tragically earlier this year, late last year, and in Armstrong County to replace Jeff Pyle, who had stepped down for health reasons, among other things. Very Republican seats. Republicans walked away with both races. So we'll have Abby Major in the 60th district replacing Jeff Pyle, and Leslie Rossi in the 59th, Westmoreland County, a little bit of Somerset County, replacing Mike Reese.
Yeah, and so this brings us back to the governor's use of unilateral power. I know that the Republicans in the House and Senate were waiting for these vacancies to be filled before coming back and making another try at overriding Governor Wolf's veto of legislation that would require him to involve the General Assembly in entering Pennsylvania into this a carbon tax arrangement with mm-hmm. the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. So it'll be interesting to see when the House and Senate majority leadership mobilizes that effort to see whether there are to see if more Democrats shake loose, because the governor having been defeated on these constitutional questions, I would think that would be a sign that his one-man show is getting bad reviews.
And I think a key point to make with the governor's defeat in the constitutional amendments is that it was not an Republican versus Democrat election.
Correct.
This was a primary election. Republicans vote on one ballot, Dems on the other. Certain independents could only vote for the constitutional questions. So it was a bipartisan majority, pretty clear bipartisan majority, voting against the governor. So there are many Democrats looking at the results of this election, elected Democrats, I should say, and getting a little nervous about the state of their party, because the average Democrat is not a progressive. And they are getting pretty upset with how the trajectory of the party moving left.
And to your point about Reggie, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, Dave, that you just brought up, I know I was just in a meeting last week about that, and I know the administration is planning to move forward with that full steam ahead, and they plan to finalize it and publish it by the end of the year. So that is definitely something that if the General Assembly plans to respond to that, it is ripe to do that very soon, because it definitely is moving. And I think Jeremy's right about the frustration with many sort of middle of the road Democrats in the state, especially in Western Pennsylvania, who have recently been frustrated by the effects of some of the more extreme environmental policies that we're looking at. Reggie is just one more thing to add to the list of their frustrations.
Along with the four legislative special elections, we also had the partisan primaries for the statewide jurists, mm-hmm. Justices and judges. How did that play out?
Certainly. So the Republicans had a contested primary for Supreme Court, and then there was one Superior Court seat open, two Commonwealth Court seats open. Neither of those seats were contested. So in the race for Supreme Court, Kevin Brobson who the Commonwealth Partners had endorsed, and we think very highly of him as a Commonwealth Court judge and think he'll be a great Supreme Court justice.
He's actually the president judge.
He's the president judge, which means he was elected by his colleagues to lead the court. The Commonwealth Court is the court that decides every case where you have a business or person that has interests versus the government, and they kind of litigate that. And there's no current Commonwealth judges on the Supreme Court. And as we've seen with specifically Pennsylvania's current Supreme Court, we desperately need a voice for citizens on that court because it's currently owned by trial bars and unions, and yep. We can't afford that anymore. So Brobson won pretty handily. We're excited to see what will happen in the general. The Democrats are actually still sorting out who won some of their down ballot races.
Interesting.
So the race for Commonwealth Court is still undecided between his last name is his Spurgeon and Amanda Green Hawkins, both from Pittsburgh for Commonwealth Court.
Interesting.
David Spurgeon.
As the listeners always hear me say, representative self-government is not a spectator sport. That it's incumbent on all of us as Americans to exercise our citizenship, to live our lives with our brains turned on, and to do the work of finding out who these folks are who are running for office, their backgrounds, their records, and to be able to make an informed decision. And that these judge posts are incredibly important. I mean, we all look back to 2015 when there were three openings on the Supreme Court. And that that the trial bar and the unions plowed in millions and millions of dollars, and they swept those three seats, and that's the beginning of the activism that we have seen, where the jurists, the state Supreme Court, imposed a unilateral gerrymander on our congressional map, overthrowing the one that was approved as is proper through the political process with all of the stakeholders and all of the
– a bipartisan majority voted yes on those maps.
That's right. There's give and take. And so the seat that is being filled is that of Chief Justice Tom Saylor, a Republican who's retiring due to mandatory retirement due to age. And so if the Democrats win that seat, then it'll be a 6-1 Democrat seat as opposed to a 5-2 if Brobson prevails. So it'll be interesting. I mean, I think it'll say a lot about the political terrain going into 2022, which is obviously even more important, where you had an open seat for governor and an open seat for U.S. Senate occurring in the same cycle. In reflecting on, you know, the overall patterns that you see from, you know, from the election, from the outcome, and from the mood of the public. And Jeremy, I'll start with you. Where do you think we go from here?
So the election should be very encouraging for Republicans. Usually you see a turnout of, you know, 550,000, 600,000 Republicans turn out in a off-year primary, and there are almost a million Republican votes in this primary. Now, I think the story on the Republicans that you see in the media is that they're defeated, that they're divided, that they're confused, that they're frustrated. Whatever that narrative is, they clearly came out and voted en masse during the primary. Democrats also had a higher turnout by about 200,000 votes. Usually about 800,000 Democrats vote in the primary. It was close to a million as well. That can be attributed to some competitive races in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh for DA and mayor respectively.
Right.
But also mail-in balloting certainly had an impact on the turnout.
And I suppose we should make a quick note here that several incumbent mayors went down, the mayor of Pittsburgh and the mayor of Harrisburg, and I believe was also the mayor of Reading.
I can't speak to Reading, but you're correct. I mean, it was a shock to see Peduto lose. I don't think many people saw that coming. Then the mayor of Harrisburg also lost a very competitive primary amongst five Democrats.
So that's also a sign of people insisting on change. So Rebecca, what do you take away from what we saw in the election, and what do you think will come next?
Well, I don't know. I agree with Jeremy. I think a lot of people were angry, frustrated, worked up. I think we saw that in the turnout, especially with Republicans. Like you said, there were several counties that ran out of Republican ballots. The turnout was so high. So I think that's absolutely true. But how that's going to play out in November or even more importantly next year, I'm not sure. I think it kind of depends on where we go from here, what the economy is going to look like over the next year or so. But I do think there's a lot of sort of unrest boiling under the surface. I think that's definitely true. So I think we saw that, and we're going to have to see how things go over the next couple months and over the next year to see where that sort of unrest manifests itself in elections. So I'm not sure if I have a good prediction, but I just there's something boiling under the surface, I think, that we're going to see.
I mean, I'm just glad that I get to be with you good folks to see it all happen. And so the listeners know that we'll all be back to be with you and to share insights and hopefully some wisdom and updates on what's happening. So we're almost out of time here. Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us here. And where can folks go to learn more about Commonwealth Partners?
You can find us at thecommonwealthpartners.com, on Twitter at @opportunity4PA.
Outstanding. Thank you. Rebecca, where can people learn more about you and the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association?
We are at pmta.org or on Facebook or Twitter.
Wonderful. And as ever, you can find me online at pamanufacturers.org and on Sunday mornings at 8:30 on the Pennsylvania Cable Network with PMA Perspective. So for Rebecca and Jeremy and me, thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
Thank you, David. With apologies to Charles Dickens, he was the best of governors, he was the worst of governors. It was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness. Such sums up the tale of two states, Florida and Pennsylvania, and their disparate responses to the COVID-19 pandemic. The contrast was brought into full focus during primary election week. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, a rapidly rising star in the National Republican Party, was the featured speaker at the Republican Committee of Allegheny County's annual spring dinner. DeSantis was celebrated for his deft handling of the pandemic and for the Sunshine State's measured approach to the crisis. DeSantis spurned the draconian shutdown measures enacted by blue state governors, ending shutdowns and mask mandates early in the pandemic. Despite having the largest senior population in the nation, the most vulnerable demographic group to the disease, Florida's numbers ranked among the lowest in the nation. Florida's economy has also rebounded quickly. Unemployment, which spiked a year ago at the height of the pandemic, has returned to normal levels. Business closures were held to a minimum. Bars and restaurants resumed normal operations. Mass distribution of the vaccine proceeded smoothly and in a timely manner. While DeSantis basked in the glow of his fellow Republicans in Pittsburgh, voters statewide were handing Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf an historic comeuppance. Following the lead of other blue state governors, including New York's Andrew Cuomo and Michigan's Gretchen Whitmer, Wolf assumed dictatorial powers, issuing unilateral decrees, imposing draconian shutdowns, and trampling individual rights, all this without legislative or stakeholder consultation and done in abeyance of the state's open record laws and generally accepted standards of transparency. The Republican-controlled legislature tried mightily to counter Wolf's excesses, only to be blocked by repeated gubernatorial vetoes. Having had enough, the legislature took the rare step of voting to end the governor's emergency powers. By law, that resolution required no signature by the governor. But Pennsylvania's activist union-controlled state Supreme Court effectively rewrote the law, giving Wolf a temporary victory. And then something amazing happened. It is important that we pause here for a moment to reflect on how truly unique and significant is this moment in our Commonwealth's history. Amending the state constitution is a necessarily difficult process. Since it was adopted in 1968, Pennsylvania's constitution has been amended 46 times. None of those amendments were passed to curb the power of the state's chief executive during a still unfolding circumstance. For the state constitution to be amended, it must pass two consecutive sessions of the General Assembly in exactly the same form. Passing legislation once is difficult, doing so twice without changing the bill, exceedingly rare. But lawmakers did just that, setting up the final step in the process, a statewide voter referendum to approve amendments that would give the General Assembly the clear power to end a gubernatorial declaration of emergency. Tom Wolf knew he was in trouble. Grassroots rebellion against his dictates had been strong since the beginning of the pandemic. Now those he had subjugated would make the final decision. Using Orwellian doublespeak, the governor claimed the pending referendum was anti-democratic. He then unleashed a campaign of disinformation about the amendments, sending out an array of state officials to peddle gloom and doom predictions, and having the ballot questions themselves written in a confusing and misleading manner. It was all for naught. On Tuesday, May 18th, we the people of Pennsylvania went to the polls and restored our liberty. The amendments that would curb the power of Tom Wolf and future governors were approved. When final election results are certified, balance between the legislative and executive branches of state government will be restored. Passage of these amendments represents an unprecedented rebuke of a sitting governor. Unlike California, we lack the ability to recall a rogue executive. This was essentially a vote of no confidence in Tom Wolf and his administration, which has bungled virtually every aspect of the pandemic response. Now it is up to the General Assembly. While understanding that the pandemic is ongoing and a measured response is still necessary, the time has come to put an end to most of Tom Wolf's egregious policies. And if they want a roadmap on what to do next, lawmakers should look south. Ron DeSantis and Florida have shown us the way forward. With a Town Hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry.
And the 2021 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is now less than 2 weeks away. After being virtual last year, an in-person conference will be held June 11th and 12th at the Radisson Penn Harris Convention Center in Camp Hill. The Pennsylvania Leadership Conference, of course, is the premier gathering of conservative activists each year here in the Keystone State. Featured speakers this year include Jesse Waters, host of Waters World on the Fox News Channel, Fox News contributor Jason Chaffetz, along with John Gizzi of Newsmax. Complete information, including the conference agenda and registration for the 2021 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference, can be found at paleadershipconference.org. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, lincolnradiojournal.com and lincolninstitute.org. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. We'll be right back.
Thank you.